This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Nick Fogarty. Coming up, calls from the Pacific for Australia to tone down the rhetoric on the Solomon Islands-China Treaty. East Timor's youth vote propels José Ramos Horta to a presidential election victory. And Victoria provides a model for a possible Pacific Island Commonwealth Games. First, though, the Solomon Islands government has ignored pleas from Australia to ditch a treaty with China, which could see Beijing establish a military presence less than 2,000 kilometres from the Queensland coast. But what are the broader implications of the treaty? And is the concern being expressed by political leaders in Australia, New Zealand and the United States justified? Dr. Tarcisius Kabutalaka is a former director of the Centre for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii and one of the region's most respected political analysts. He told Richard Ewart that some of the rhetoric coming from the Australian opposition in particular has much to do with the ongoing election campaign, and he points out that the Solomon security deal with China is actually not the first in the Pacific.
I'm not sure whether it is the biggest blunder since the Cold War period. And the reason I'm saying that is because the agreement between Solomon Islands and China is not the only security agreement between China and a Pacific Island country. In fact, Fiji has a security agreement with China. This was signed in 2011, and then they had a supplementary MOU in 2014. And I've seen copies of both documents, and they're much more comprehensive than the Solomon Islands agreement. What we've seen, though, is that Fiji has been able to manage that relationship relatively well in ways that it doesn't cause the kind of concern that the Solomon Islands China security agreement has caused.
It's interesting you make the comparison with what happened in Fiji, because of course that deal was signed when the country was still under military rule, before they had their first democratic election of the new era, if I can put it that way. This deal in Solomon Islands has been agreed by a democratically elected government and a prime minister who insists that there will be no Chinese military base built in Solomon Islands, but it's as if people frankly don't believe him.
I think that's what we are seeing. Although I think the concern, particularly coming from Australia and to a certain extent within the Solomons as well, is that questions about the capacity of the Solomon Islands government to manage this relationship. That's a huge concern. The second is that because of Solomon Islands' proximity to Australia, but also because of Australia's engagement with the Solomons in terms of the resources that it has put into policing, into law and order, into other things in the Solomons. I mean, Australia's police engagement with the Solomon Islands since 2003, apart from Papua New Guinea, is the largest in the Pacific Islands region, through Ramsey and the following Ramsey. And so there's a lot of investment from Australia in the Solomon Islands. And I think there is concern in Canberra that increasing Chinese influence would see all that investment wasted, if not marginalized.
But if we look at the Pacific as a whole, you would struggle, I think, to find any Pacific Island nation that doesn't have some connection with China. And I'm just wondering why this one is causing so much consternation. I mean, clearly the word security is key. But in the end, Prime Minister Sogavare says in Parliament this morning he wants to beef up the police force. That's what he sees it as. He doesn't see it as anything bigger than that. At least that's what he told Parliament.
Yeah, that's true. I think part of the challenge in the case of the Solomons is the potential for these geopolitical discussions becoming domesticated and therefore causing problems within the country. Solomon Islanders are reading things that are put out in Australia and then using it for domestic discussions. And what we've seen in the Solomons as a result of this debate about China versus the West is that there is an increasing polarization of opinions in the country that could potentially lead to domestic conflict, whether that be violent or not. I think that's a big concern in the Solomon Islands. In terms of Australia, New Zealand, and so forth being concerned about China, for Australia, and I think the Australian government officials have made this clear, that it's not only about ensuring that they protect their dominance in the region, but also ensuring that whatever happens in their neighbour doesn't become a domestic security issue for Australia.
Do you get the sense that those who are unhappy about this deal, they're trying to put across the idea that China is going to do something, but nobody seems to be able to define what exactly it is that China may or may not do? If the Prime Minister of Solomon Islands says that he will not allow China to build a military base in his country, surely that should be good enough, shouldn't it? But what you seem to be saying is perhaps Solomon Islands, small country as it is, with a bit of a checkered political history, might not be able to manage that situation.
I do not believe that China is going to build a military base or a naval base in the Solomon Islands. And the reason is that, one, it's going to create a lot of pushback within the Solomon Islands, as well as from Solomon Islands' traditional partners. And I don't think that Beijing wants to deal with that kind of pushback that would, in a way, spoil its reputation in the Pacific, where already, according to traditional partners, they see China as a threat. The second reason is that if China were to be able to have access to the region in terms of its police, as well as its military personnel, as well as its naval base, in the way that we see in the security agreement, then there is indeed no need for a physical military base in the near future.
Political scientist and a former director of the Center for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii, Dr. Tarcisius Kabutalaka. Nobel laureate Jose Ramos Horta is the president of Timor-Leste once again. Preliminary results from the runoff against the incumbent Francisco Guterres put Mr. Ramos Horta well ahead with 62% of the vote. Having previously served as president and prime minister, he appears to have polled well with the young people of Timor-Leste, with one example being 21-year-old Lobito de Jesus from the organisation Timor Youth for Peace. Marion Farr caught up with him.
I know that he's excellent and he knows well about the politics in our country, because he's also the former president, and he knows well about what our people need, and especially he also have a good relationship with other countries. That's why, of course, he will establish and maintaining the bilateral cooperation with the other countries, the foreign countries, and also he also has a good vision for Timorese people and also for the country.
As a young person in Timor-Leste, what do you hope the next president will do for the country and for young people?
So, well, that's a good question. As a young people and representative of my young Timorese people, I hope that he's going to be lead the country and represent the people as a president to bring peace and accomplish what they have promised to their people on their campaigns.
And what are the main issues that affect young people in the country?
I think one of the main issues is that the unemployment, because as you know, that a lot of Timorese people are going out to the foreign countries to seek for a job. And I hope that for the next president, they might open opportunity. That's the main issue that I currently observing. So the problem is about unemployment for young people.
Well, Lobito, that's pretty much all I had to ask. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Anything else you'd like to say about this election before we wrap up our interview?
I'm really happy for this election, because the election, there is no more conflict between the party supporters, and also the yesterday election was very peaceful around the territories. So I never seen this peaceful campaign and election like that before. So I would like to congratulate for the Timorese people, because they have been growing up and they have been proving their maturity. And I hope that for the future, we still keep improving this situation, because what we really like the most is about the peaceful for our people and the peaceful for our country.
Lobito de Jesus speaking to Marion Farr. A new report from UNAIDS shows that HIV cases in Fiji have risen by over 100% in the last decade. It comes as funding for outreach and education programs has fallen, and shows that Fiji is an outlier when compared to other Pacific countries like PNG, where HIV cases have only risen by 30%. UNAIDS Country Director for Fiji and the Pacific, Renata Rahm, spoke with reporter Jordan Fennell about the worrying trend.
In most countries in the world, HIV new infections have actually been decreasing. But for Fiji, we've seen a very steep rise. And this is a very concerning and alarming figure for us to be presented with.
So what's caused such a big rise in HIV cases?
There are many drivers that has resulted in this. And the one main factor is the reduced funding landscape, which has led to reduced programming within the health service system, as well as the wider community, as HIV outreach programs have become largely unfunded and unsustainable.
What age group or demographic are we seeing the biggest number of these rises in cases?
The increase that we're seeing, the 116% since 2010. And what's very worrying is that there's a doubling of new HIV infections among young people. So this is the 15 to 24 years age group. Also, there's an increasing mother-to-child infections around the world. Even countries in Africa are reporting minimal mother-to-child infections. In some countries with higher epidemics have zero. But Fiji last year reported 6 new cases of mother-to-child infections. And we have like now a whole generation of young people who have low HIV knowledge. And this is another worrying fact for Fiji, is that we're in the wake of an emerging threat of another driver for HIV infections. And this is the use of synthetic drugs in Fiji, and especially through sharing needles. So in many other countries, the main mode of HIV transmission is through sharing needles rather than unprotected sex. And now we have these two active risky behaviors within the community.
I'm wondering, more of a, on a personal note for you, obviously you work in this space quite heavily on policy, and you're seeing it play out, you know, over these past couple of years. How do you feel seeing such a sharp rise in the numbers in Fiji?
It was quite worrying. And I really, you know, if something is not done about this now, if we do not revitalize the HIV programming, we are going to see at least 50% more rise in new infections. And our HIV curve will keep going up, and we may never see the peak of it if we don't address these issues quickly. And now we really need to upscale HIV programming and really put out HIV knowledge. Most young people now, they basically do not know much about HIV treatment, about its availability, about effects of it, and also about prevention as well.
Aside from the funding of the programs, are there any other main reasons as to why perhaps diseases and things like HIV aren't talked about enough in Fiji?
There's a lot of barriers to any sexual health issue. And so starting from a cultural perspective, talking about sex is a very taboo subject in the Pacific. Due to this conservatism, our awareness programs are quite challenging. Unsafe sex practices are the main mode of HIV transmission in Fiji, but there's so much silence in the community on sex. When elders or when people in the community talk about sex, there's an emphasis on abstinence and the negative consequences of sex. And young people are really discouraged about talking about this and about sexuality as well, which, you know, it's a very big concern here. There's a lack of understanding that conversations about sex need to be seen as sexual health and as health advice. Elders need to understand that providing young people with information to make empowered or safer choices is what should be the driving factor of these sexual health talks.
That was Renata Rahm, the UNAIDS Fiji Country Director, speaking with reporter Jordan Fennell. Well, could the decision to award the 2026 Commonwealth Games to the Australian state of Victoria have opened up a future pathway for the Pacific to host the multi-sports event? If a group of Victorian cities can come together to stage the Games, then why not a group of Pacific Island countries? As Evan Wasuka reports, the Pacific has flirted with the idea in the past, but now might be the time to sit down and put together a substantive bid.
Some 4,500 athletes from more than 70 countries are expected to attend the Commonwealth Games in England in late July, numbers beyond the capability of most Pacific countries to handle. Although Papua New Guinea, through the then Governor-General Sir Michael Ogio, raised a tentative hand while basking in the euphoria of the closing ceremony at the Pacific Games in Port Moresby 7 years ago.
Can Papua New Guinea host a Commonwealth Games? Yes, together we can. Papua New Guinea must bid to host the 2026 Games here in Port Moresby and around the country.
PNG's economic struggle over recent years have put paid to any realistic hope of hosting such a big event alone. But what if they were part of a joint bid? Dr. Robin Mitchell is the president of ONOC, the Oceania National Olympic Committee, and he says a joint Pacific bid was actually mooted some time ago, although surprisingly, perhaps it didn't involve PNG.
We talked about it quite a while ago, possibility of Fiji, Tonga, Samoa bidding because we're so close to each other. I think it was after the Com Games in Melbourne, actually, in 2006. We had talked about that option, and then Samoa went ahead and got the Commonwealth Youth Games. So it's been talked about, but we haven't progressed it. Probably something we would chat about at the Commonwealth meeting on the 29th of April in Nandi.
And Dr. Mitchell says travel times between the three countries would be no greater than those between host cities for the 2026 Games in Victoria.
Flying wise, it's less than an hour to Tonga from Suva and just a little over an hour to Apia. Samoa's got quite a lot of facilities now. We're looking at building up to bid again probably after Tahiti, I think, was the last discussions locally in Fiji. So probably give us a call after the 29th.
ONOC Secretary General is Ricardo Blas, and he says many factors would need to be considered before a joint bid could be lodged.
If it's a split venue, the question would be who's going to underwrite the cost for the movement of athletes and their officials to and from those venues. We had a similar situation in the 1991 Pacific Games in Papua New Guinea. They had it in Port Moresby, and then they had three or four other sports up in Leh. The logistics doing that was quite extensive. A combined event, I mean, sure, it might be an interest for both countries because then they would have the resources to cover those costs. But how would that affect the members in terms of having two sets of management team, identifying who's going to be taking the lead in terms of responsibilities?
In the meantime, the Pacific Olympic Committees are looking to maximize the advantage of having the 2026 Commonwealth Games on their doorstep, and then the Olympics in Brisbane 6 years later.
Dr. Mitchell, our president, started to engage a representative that resides in Brisbane to start developing a program to address a 10-year plan for all the ONOC members, minus Australia and New Zealand. So there is a plan. We have engaged with some of the government officials in Brisbane, preliminary discussions regarding how to develop a 10-year plan that will help develop athletes for the Games.
We've been talking to the Australian Olympic Committee and the Australian government as well. You know, the Australian government is running quite a few programs around the region at the moment. And for us, we really need to step up again compared to lead up to Sydney, where quite a few of the NOCs had just become Olympic committees, and the starting standard was much lower than we have at the moment. So the project's going ahead. We're launching it July 23rd, and we've already started talking with possible training centres in Brisbane.
ONOC's 10-year strategy to boost Pacific athletes' Olympic prospects in Brisbane will no doubt be laid out before the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, when he attends ONOC's General Assembly next month.
To attend the General Assembly is really important because then it allows the opportunity for all the NOC leaders to meet up with the president personally, talk to them about their programs in their country, the challenges, and how to move forward in terms of this ever-threatening crisis of COVID and other restrictions that we now face.
So if the 10-year strategy works out well for the Pacific, what level of success is ONOC looking for? It would appear the president's ambitions are more modest than those of his secretary general.
I think our target is quite modest but achievable. It's more to get more of our athletes to qualify on merit and looking at perhaps qualifying in the top 8 to top 10. Top 8, you get a diploma, an official diploma.
The goal is to medal at the Olympic Games. If gold is achievable for many of the member countries, I think the playbook would be to follow the 10-year plan. But we hope to see Samoa and Solomons and Kiribati medal in the weightlifting programs. They do have the potential.
Meanwhile, on the question of a joint Commonwealth Games bid after Victoria in 2026, the Canadian city of Hamilton is in pole position for 2030. But perhaps 2034 could be the year when sport in the Pacific comes of age and the rest of the Commonwealth comes to the Pacific.
Evan Wasuka reporting. The fireball that blazed over the Pacific back in 2014 has finally been identified as a very rare interstellar meteorite. Recently declassified data from the US Space Command helped Harvard University scientists prove their suspicion that the flying object was indeed a meteor. The finding makes it the earliest interstellar meteorite known to hit Earth. Dr. Brad Tucker, an astrophysicist from the Australian National University, spoke with Marion Farr about its significance.
You know, it was just a small meteorite that came through, small being half a meter. Now, that doesn't sound, you know, that big, but 50 centimeters, we get a lot of these. But they're usually big enough and bright enough to be seen. So we see it, people record it, and we notice it. Now, it entered somewhere over Southeast Asia and the Pacific. What was peculiar about it that caught people's eye later was the angle and the speed of it. So most things come from a very certain set kind of angle and direction. That is, most of the asteroids are orbiting around the solar system in the asteroid belt, and they have some variation of where they come from, but they're relatively all coming into the solar system at kind of the angle. This kind of came out from on top, so to speak. So if you imagine the solar system as a giant disk, this kind of came from on top of that disk, and it was traveling really fast in compared to other meteorites. And so this surprised people who studied it a little bit later, because this didn't seem to match the normal course of meteorites as they come in.
Dr. Tucker, we know that this meteorite passed over the Pacific. Did people in Pacific countries see this meteorite when it sort of came through the atmosphere?
So yeah, so there was a few reports of it hitting, because this thing was relatively large. Again, not large in the scale of any damage, but large in the scale of burning very bright and very noticeable in the sky. And so there's a lot of big work now that we're doing, especially here in Australia, that we'd love to roll out to the Pacific, where by building a bunch of cameras and actually using also an app, people can report and we can see when these meteorites come from. Because if you have enough people who say, hey, I'm here and I saw it, and then you can trace where that meteorite goes.
Wow. And what do you think the chances are that we might find fragments of this meteorite?
Look, as of now, it's hard to say. It's always small, because even if you can pinpoint it landed within 10 square kilometers, you still have to look for a small rock in 10 square kilometers, because it's not going to leave a crater. These things are small enough that it's going to be a small rock that lands on the ground, and you're not going to notice it. The Pacific is actually a little bit harder, because you obviously have lots of water, so it's more likely to land in the ocean. And even if it does land on land, it's going to land more likely in a densely vegetated area. It's a lot harder to find it in a forest or the jungle. But given how special and rare it is, there's talks about if we can get a good location, can we map it? And so there's been new technology we've been rolling out in Australia to use drones and AI. So there's talks that we can, again, if we have a decent enough area, maybe do this in the Pacific. And this would be, you know, the meteorite of the century.
Wow. Well, it sort of sounds like there's a bit of a treasure hunt. It's got a bit of a treasure hunt feel to it.
It does. It really, it's scientific modern day treasure hunting. That's right. And the great thing is there's been a lot of work, and again, led by people in Curtin as part of the Fireballs project, that has started to do this, because this is what we want to do. And now this is such a rare object, you know, it's worth the hunt like any treasure.
Astrophysicist Brad Tucker speaking there to Marion Farr. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.